Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on January 12, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, and I'm glad that you joined me tonight for this live, during this live broadcast. I want to thank Richard from Chicago for his generous donation this week. Richard is a regular contributor and is much appreciated. Tonight's show is about Holocaust or Holo-Hoax. No matter what else you might hear being said, no matter what is the issue of the day or what is in the center of discussion currently, it all leads back to Holocaust. Holocaust is the most important subject in the world because no matter what else you see or hear about important events, it does all go back to Holocaust. It cannot be ignored, that is the Holocaust. And I repeat, it can't be ignored if you want to have relevance. So now we're in the time of the year when the entire world is asked to remember the victims of the Holocaust, for the Holocaust is the accepted symbol of man's inhumanity to man, the symbol of evil and of racial violence and genocide. Or I might say that since 1945, this has been the case. It couldn't have been, and it wasn't the case before that, but now it so quickly has taken on the all-encompassing symbol of, as I just said, evil and man's inhumanity to man. And, of course, it all was perpetrated by Germans. That's another very important point to remember. I'd like to say that considered the Holocaust is considered to be the result of anti-Semitism also, and that's brought up a lot and more these days. But it is also clear that this is mostly only important and meaningful to Jews or the Jewish community. So all this is something to keep in mind as we go through tonight's program. This is a live show, so I do have a call-in at 323-642-1206. That's 323-642-1206. As usual, by the time showtime comes around, I have plenty of material that I seem to think is important since I worked on it, and I don't want to not talk about it. So I'm always ambivalent about callers. I do, if you call, I do welcome callers, particularly in the second hour. I might get through quite a bit of this in the first hour. And if you keep it, you know, to the subjects that I'm talking about here and commenting on that rather than going off into something, you know, that's not so relevant. But that is not usually a problem here, so I shouldn't always be bringing it up. So I'll just keep that in mind. I'll try to keep watching the calling screen, and you know I'm understanding it better and better all the time. So I think I've got a pretty good handle on it right now. The only thing is if I have to remember to look at it. It's right there on the page, but sometimes I go to other pages, and then if I don't get back to this page, I only have two different things on my screen. When I do a show, I go back and forth between things rather than have a whole bunch of little images to follow. So anyway, the first thing I want to talk about tonight is something that just came up and doesn't really so much fit into the topic, but I'm adamant about mentioning it. And that has to do with the Rebel website. It's the actual name of the Rebel website is the Rebel.website. It's not .com or .org or anything. It's .website. It's run by Andrew Winkler, although he never uses his name anymore. Seems to want to stay very far under the radar. And I have a problem, as I've had for years and years, with Andrew Winkler and his Rebel website. Let's see, my complaint goes back to October 1st, 2013. And, I guess I should say first that currently on the Rebel website. You'll, it's a site where he has sections for all different kind of people that he considers some kind of truth tellers or white nationalists or revisionists and so on. And currently, he has me up there. My name is listed. I was going to go to that page. Let me do that right now. I forgot to do it. I knew I wanted to go to somewhere. So I can, if I need to refer to that, it's very slow. It's a very, very slow site to load. So I'm there, and all of my blogs from CarolynJaeger.net from October of last year, 2014, are there. Now, what happened was, and I've written to him. I actually wrote to him 2 or 3 days ago, but I found out just a few hours ago that I never sent it. I had forgotten to send it. So, but I had written in the meantime this afternoon. So I have to admit that he has not gotten the complaint from me in time to do anything about it. Let me try this EN. Well, wait and see. It's still not connecting. There it goes. Here it is. All right. And let me see if my name's still here. Yes, it is. All right. Well, so given that, I want to say that there's still no excuse for it because 2 years ago, October 2013, October 1st, I discovered that he has my material up, and he had a lot of my copyrighted material up on his site also. He had a whole section for me, and he has a section for a whole lot of people. Many of them, well, I think it's changed quite a bit from back in 2013. It seemed to me there were other names that aren't there anymore, so maybe those people also asked to be taken off. And there's a lot of people I don't even recognize, whereas back then they were mostly people I did recognize, although there's a lot of them here. But I, for one, do not want to be on his website, and I'm going to explain. But first I'm going to say that on October 1st, 2013, when I discovered all this, I wrote to him, and I have these emails. I have them right here. I saved them, and I said to him, "You do not have permission to upload my copyrighted material to your website, nor to upload any of my writings from Elie Wiesel Conns the World," he had some of those then, "or from CarolynJaeger.net, nor from thewhitenetwork.com. So I made it a point that I didn't want him to upload anything of mine, not just what was copyrighted. And I say, you know, it's really appalling that you have just grabbed my work in this way, because he didn't ask permission or ask me about it. It's one thing to link to another website, but quite another thing to republish someone's work lock, stock, and barrel, especially without even asking first. I signed my name. Well, I got a reply from him at that time, and he said, "Carolyn, my apologies for republishing your materials without your prior consent. I must admit, though, that I'm a bit surprised by your attitude. I haven't come across a fellow dissident yet," who he calls us a fellow dissidents, "who wasn't more than happy to have his materials republished on my site, provided I link back to the original article, cite the original author, etc., given the fact that it helps spread the word and drives traffic back to their site." I'm not so sure about that. In fact, I don't agree with that. And he finishes up, "In the interest of the common cause, I appeal to you to reconsider and allow me to continue to publish your materials." Well, I wrote right back to him and said, "Absolutely not. Remove my materials and my name from your site right now." And he did. I didn't save that other email. I just have these two. So that was the end of that. And let me just say that I'd gotten into disagreements with Andrew Winkler before this time, before October 2013, quite a bit before, I think, on a discussion forum that I used to participate. I'm still on, but I used to participate. There used to be more discussion on it. And I had expressed my disagreements with him. on my serious reservations about him at that time. And so he knew I was not friendly toward him. But I don't know what caused me to go there, but something, and I happened, the page came out. I was Googling something. And then I saw my name and something by me, and I saw that it was at the Rebel. And I said, So I went and looked, and there he had started this past October 2014, several months ago, a few months ago, not too long. And he started picking up my material, and he has every single post that I made at CarolynJaeger.net from that time until now, every single one. He has some kind of automatic thing that just picks everything up, I guess, and keeps it running along there. I do not think I'm being helped by that. I think I'm being harmed by it. Other people might go along with him, or other people just might not want to bother or have a different attitude about things like this, and they might like him, they like the site, or they might just say, well, it doesn't hurt anything, or I don't want to complain, it's not important to me, I'll just leave it be, but I do think that I know that there were quite a number of names back then, at least that in 2013, that are not there now, and I think the quality that he's got, except for a few exceptions, has gone down. So maybe I'm not the only one who doesn't want to be used like he is using all of us to create a money-making website for himself. I know he says he doesn't make any money. People believe all that, and maybe he's not. But he's from the back in 2000. He says he started in 2006. I know he started with Zyopedia. And I was aware of that site at the time. And even then on Zyopedia, which wasn't like his Rebel website, but he picked up other people's work generally. He didn't write much of his own, although I think he wrote some. It was an anti-Zionist type site. And he's still basically anti-Zionist. But even back then, he was using these sleazy kind of fundraising tactics, and he was every so often though. Then it wasn't constant. Then he would come along and say, "Oh boy, I don't have enough money to keep this site going. I'm not getting donations, and if I don't get such and such amount of money by such and such a time, this site's going to go down. You know, I can't keep it up." And a lot in the beginning, people would say, "Oh no, we don't want that to happen," because there wasn't too many good sites at the time, and they'd send him, and he'd get, you know, a bunch of donations. But as time went on, I don't think he got them. And then he dropped Zyopedia, and he went on to this Rebel site. And he used to have one of those thermometer things that shows that how much money you need. You know, he'd go on these fundraising things, and he'd want, you know, a large amount of money, like, you know, several thousand dollars. And it would somehow show, you know, if it was how much he had gotten so far and if it was reaching that. And he had that up, and he'd say, "I need this amount of money by such and such a time. And if not, I'm going to close the site because I can't keep it up without donations from you people." And if he didn't get the donations, he never closed the site. And people began to realize, some times were pretty stupid, takes a while, that he was just using that. And I realized that early on, and I thought I didn't like it, I didn't approve of it, and that was one of the things we were disagreeing about way back when on that discussion forum I mentioned. So what I find now, and if you go to that, the rebel.website, and then the page that you go to is /EN, which stands for English, I'm pretty sure, because he's got a German site, and he might have a French site, but it's not the same material on it. And he has at the top now of every page, he's had different kind of things like this. So this is the new one that I've just seen, since I haven't looked at his site for well over a year. But he's got at the top of every single page you go to, the Rebel website needs your help. And he writes, he's got this little gimmicky thing showing that he lost his domain name, but he changed his domain name because he thought this new one called .website was cheaper. But it works, I don't know if it works as well because it takes a long time for it to load. But he says, each month I spend over $1,000 U.S. and hundreds of unpaid hours of work to provide this feisty Aussie site to, he claims, 120,000 to 150,000 unique readers from around the world. I doubt it. This is only possible for as long as my readers help me wear the cost. If they don't, the Rebel will be suspended and discontinued. See, he's been saying this very thing for at least 8 years. 8 years he does this. He has it on all the pages. And so here's the thing. Now, he goes on and talks about how much money he needs, what it costs him, and so on, which is too much. It's way too much for what it should. But, you know, I can't really argue that because he does have a large site. He doesn't need to have all this stuff on here because who cares about it? And maybe some of it doesn't even have anything there. It's just says he's got a forum. Does he really have a forum? Or you have to join it to find out. I haven't joined anything there, so I don't want to go there. But on every page he's got this. So the point I'd like to make is that if he's got pages with my work on it, which he doesn't take him anything except to just steal. I call it stealing it, but, you know, uploading it, downloading it, and then uploading it to him. So if he's got quite a number of pages with my work on it, and every time somebody goes to one of these pages to read something that I've written, when they could go to my own website, but why should they go to my website when he's got it all there, word for, you know, with the pictures, everything, exactly as I've posted it. So he hasn't redone it. He's just taken it in the way it is. And, well, they don't, if they're used to coming to the Rebel to look at this stuff, they don't have to come to my website, do they? So I don't see that in the first, number one, that he is helping me at all when he says, oh, he said to me that, oh, this helps people come to your website and look at it. I don't think so. And I have a right to my own thinking, so I don't believe that's true. And but then with all the more pages he has that he can get people to maybe want to go and read, he can give them this big, large fundraising spiel at the top that they can't overlook. You know, he used to have it on the side, but you couldn't really overlook that now. But now it's at the very top. You have to scroll down past it to see what's there. Now, I'm looking for, there's a page that says donate or something. And he's got more written there that's pretty amazing stuff. He says, the amount I've been paying since upgrading to the current dedicated enterprise server. This is just part of what he's written on this donate page. In December 2013, it's comparably low. It only amounts to about two-thirds of my monthly website-related costs. In addition to the basic web hosting fee, there are things like domain name hosting, SSL service, various safety options, plus annual and half-yearly license subscription fees for the software I'm using, such as the Facebook-like community software, the YouTube-like video hosting streaming software, the Blogspot-like blog software, and the recently added commenting and forum features, plus various site management tools I use on a daily basis. That's how I end up spending a minimum of $1,250 per month, quite a challenge given the fact that I work 80 to 100 hours per week on this site. He says, calls it my hobby of running the Rebel site. Under these conditions, it's almost a miracle that the site has survived for as long as 9 years. Well, because it doesn't cost that much. Couldn't possibly cost that much. And everybody who does this, I can certainly speak for myself, has to pay all my fees and pay domain names. I own quite a number of domain names, which adds up But I only own what I feel like I have to protect my domain name that I care about. And I also work all the time at it. But I'm not crying and begging constantly the way this guy does for more money. And I do all my own work. I don't steal other people's work, except once in a while I take some from someone who doesn't mind, or if they did mind, they could tell me. But as a matter of fact, they're usually people I know pretty well. Then he says, now, you know, it's a miracle this site has survived. Since 2006, this is when he says it goes back to 2006, it wouldn't have been possible without the generous financial support of my readers. Unfortunately, I can't always avoid putting a lot of not-so-subtle pressure on my readers and supporters to help me come up with the necessary funds. Given the fact that I have a young family, there's only so much money that I can divert from the family budget. Do you know how long this man has been saying this line? I remember it going way back, that he has a young family and he doesn't have that much money that he can take from the family. He used to say he was retired from a high-paying job that he gave up in order to run this website. And then he cries he doesn't have enough money for it. So none of it makes any sense, and he's just a big liar. That's what he is. And I expect that he will take my pages down that he's put up about me. And then I expect that if I don't watch it, he would later on sneak them back up again like he did this last time. I mean, it was only in 2013 in October that we had that exchange, and he doesn't forget. He knows I don't want to be on his site, but he put me on there anyway, thinking probably that I wouldn't notice. And I think he does it this way with everybody. He said that has never had any complaints like mine, which means that he doesn't ask people if he can put them up on his website. And he is, in my estimation, he is taking other people's work and lots of it and using it to create something that he is constantly asking for money for. Like I said, this big, huge money request for donations is on every top of every single page of his website, and there's a lot of pages there. So think about that. I don't really want to get into a lot of commentary about this because this is not really part of my program tonight, but I thought I needed to mention it because the only way that I can stop him and stop people doing this kind of thing is to talk about it on my radio show and make people aware of it, and then they're ashamed and they remove it. Otherwise, they won't. They wouldn't. I don't think he may have the idea that if it's on the internet, anybody can take it. Well, anybody can, but if I specifically tell him I don't want him to and refuse him permission to do what he's doing, he should certainly recognize that and certainly respect that, shouldn't he? And he shouldn't have ever put it back on there again. I don't want to be associated with him and what he's doing. Now, let's go on, close this site up, because I want to talk about a very fine person next, a wonderful man who I admire greatly, and that is Vincent Renoir. A few weeks ago, this is what he said, someone, a friend, alerted me to a video on YouTube by Renoir that had English subtitles. So I rushed to look at it, and I wanted to download it and post it at carolynyeager.net. But through a lot of confusion and trial and error, I finally learned that when you downloaded that video from YouTube with the subtitles disappeared, and you just had the regular video in French. And I don't have too many readers who understand French, I don't think. So I didn't want to put that on. But I finally posted something today that shows, that describes what he says on this wonderful video, 15-minute video that he did, and where you can watch it in, with the English subtitles. He does wonderful videos, and it's really a shame that he cannot seem to get English over voice would be even better, but English subtitles on these videos, that they're just in French. It's really a shame, but he seems to find it difficult to work to get to work with people to do it. But this Kodo poster, who I've had a lot of dealings with in the past, Kladderadatch, who goes by the name of Kladderadatch, he's a great linguist, and he's done this. He put those the English subtitles on this, and he's got a YouTube channel where he does German and French, very good videos that are not that only in German and French. And he's added the subtitles to quite a number of them. So, I mean, to a lot of them, he's got quite a number there. So I'm going to eventually watch some of these that he's got there. And I put all this information in my post, and I hope that I think everybody who listens to me certainly should watch that video. He's just nobody who has a better grasp of the meaning of World War II and the Nuremberg trials, and what they're doing to us today, than Vincent Renoir, who has been a real student of all that, and he understands it perfectly, and is able to, every time he talks about it, make so much sense. So this is the great information in the great revelation in this video, was that he is telling us that a few weeks ago he was sentenced to heavy penalties, 2,000 euro judgment of damages. I mean, not, did I say 2,000? 20,000 euros in damages in a court case brought against him by the executive editor at Charlie Hebdo, or of Charlie Hebdo. The man's name is Laurent Sorisol. He's got an alias. He's known by the magazine readers as Riss, R-I-S-S. And he's some kind of an artist, too, cartoonist. They have a lot of cartoonists there. And this lawsuit was brought against Vincent Renoir by this Laurent Sorisol. And at the final judgment, as I said, Vincent was ordered to pay 20,000 euros in damages to this idiot, and which he says he's a sum which I've never had a tenth of in my bank account. He really is a poor man, and he's constantly being dragged into court and fined for things. And that's not counting the fines, he says, which amount to nearly 70,000 euros. So you've got he supposedly owes 90,000 euros because this Charlie Hebdo executive editor took him to court. And this was just a few weeks before this great tragedy happened that everybody is going on and on about. He's poor, you know, and sympathizing with the Charlie Hebdo crowd. And Vincent says that you could say about this that he is potentially ruined for life. You know, if he earns any money and the state finds out about it, if there's anything that he's got, they're going to take it away from him to pay this thing. And these Charlie Hebdo people are based mostly Jews who are on the opposite side that we are on. And why should we care about them? Because they certainly hate all of us. They hate Vincent Renoir and the work that he does, and they want to stop him from doing it. Now, he describes what the charge was and what he had done. It was such a minor little thing that he says that a Jewish lawyer said to him at the time of the trial that the judgment could hardly exceed 1 euro in damages, since the distribution of his little book was strictly private. So he had used some sketches by this Riss in this little book that he put together and distributed privately. And this was in 2006, 8 years later or so, they decide to bring a suit against him and bring a lawsuit against him based on that, and call him guilty of counterfeiting. That's what they call it in France. Then Vincent in this goes into a wonderful description of how we are in a state of war, and that ever since 1945, that the war against, as he puts it, the war against National Socialism, well, he says ever since 1939, our countries have been at war against National Socialism and all those who represent it, including him. He expressed himself as a National Socialist. Once the Third Reich was flattened and the unconditional surrender of its armies was obtained, the war still continued, an ideological war, the first battle of which would play out at Nuremberg with the judicial lynching and hanging of high dignitaries of National Socialism. At the end of the proceedings, Robert Jackson, who was the main prosecutor for the United States, as you probably recall, said this, he's on record as saying this too, the Allies are still technically in a state of war with Germany, although the enemy's political and military institutions have collapsed. As a military tribunal, we are continuing the war effort of the Allied nations. That is, the Nuremberg Tribunal was a continuance of the war against National Socialism. And Vincent points out that this crusade has never ceased. It calmed down during the 50s and 60s, but since the 70s it has picked up again, and today it is intensifying, and like a cancer, it is growing. He says it's a perpetual crusade against racism, anti-Semitism, discrimination, sexism, homophobia, Islamism, negationism, which is their word for Holocaust denial. He says, today, anyone who strays from the path of the politically correct is immediately pilloried. They are accused of every evil. And you can watch the video and read the subtitles to learn everything he says. But he goes into a lot of history, does it so well. He's so clear-minded. I just love all of his work, but most of it I can't get anything out of because it's in French. He makes the point that even if you're in ideological war, you never know when somebody will say, well, we're in a war, and they'll decide to make it a real war and use real bullets. And that's what happened, he says, at Charlie Hebdo massacre. Now, he says in the beginning he expressed his sympathies for the families and the people who were killed. But I wouldn't do that when I learned what they were doing to Vincent, a man who doesn't do any harm except try to tell the truth as he sees it, and has family to support and so on, and they want to destroy him. They don't care. They wanted to destroy these people at Charlie Hebdo, wanted to destroy Vincent Renoir and anyone else they can destroy, like maybe Robert Faurisson and so, but they found Vincent to be a target that they had something they could use against. And they don't care anything about him and his family and his people. I don't care anything about them and their families. And I say at the end of my post that I don't feel I'm not a bit sorry about what happened, because after all, this is war. You know, one thing that I thought was humorous, he says towards the end, Vincent says, at my trial, his lawyer said that Laurent Sourisseau had been scarred by my revisionist comic book and would be claiming an exemplary reparation. Can you imagine this grown man bringing into court that what Vincent had done by using some of his little drawings in his revisionist comic book that he passed around to in private was scarred him, you know. Therefore, he deserved a large reparation. And this is Jew thinking for sure. And liberal Marxist thinking. And Vincent said he got more than he asked for. I am potentially ruined for life, but I am alive. Sourisseau has learned where this war of ideology, from which he has profited, can lead. Well, I thought that's a great lesson for us and for everybody. I hope you pass this video around, or you can't really pass it around, but you can tell people to go and watch it. And thanks to Clatterdatch for putting these English subtitles on, and he's done, as I said, he's got others that he's done, and this is such an important work, such an important help for all of us to have these translations. Well, now, I've used up a lot of my time, but I'm going now to my topic of the evening, the major subject that I want to discuss, and that is the upcoming 70th anniversary of the so-called liberation of Auschwitz. Of course, Auschwitz was really not liberated in the sense, so I always call it the liberation of Auschwitz, but it is making a big splash this year, and especially now when January 27th is coming close, and in fact, I was just adding it up today, and I keep thinking, well, still a ways to go, but my gosh, it's just 15 days from today, and I want to get a lot of things going for it, but it's just not much is going to happen this year because nobody's responding and doing much, and I've been really stressed out over a lot of other issues. So, but I'm doing what I can to bring attention to the fact that this January 27th date, which will be made a big, as they're trying to make as big a deal of it as they can. And it's really all being done by Jews. It's just a total Jewish operation, even though they have the Polish museum at Auschwitz-Birkenau supposedly in charge of it, along with, what was the other thing, other place that was in charge of it? I'll have to say that when I get to it. That it's really all the Jews, and I'm pointing out in this program today how important how the Hollywood Jews are taking the lead here in trying to make sure that this comes off very well, and there's a lot of attention to it, a lot of publicity, which will cause people to become aware of the things they want people to be aware of. And one of the themes I want to use that makes a lot of sense to me is that Auschwitz is no different than a movie set. Think about it. I mean, we've got these Hollywood heavyweights, I've called them. I picked that up actually from one of their articles. But the Hollywood heavyweights are doing all they can, and it's very fitting because this is a Hollywood production. And Auschwitz is really like a movie set. What's the difference between a tourist visiting 20th Century Fox Studio in Hollywood or wherever it's located, maybe it's in Culver City, and any other film studio in Southern California, to see the various sets that have been saved from famous past movies? And we know that you can take tours of these studios, and they have all these sets from big hit music movies from the past that they keep parts of them, and you can go see them. And it just makes me think it's just the same thing as tourists visiting the Auschwitz fake set of a supposed death camp. In reality, an ordinary work camp for criminal detainees. But they have created Auschwitz-Birkenau as something that it never was, and they now have people coming there to see what they say took place there. So it's very fitting that that Hollywood people are brought in to make this January 27th commemoration that they do, that they've been doing since 2006. Huh, them and Winkler since 2006 to bring attention to, mainly to bring attention to anti-Semitism. That's the thing they're most concerned with. They don't care that much about, but they also want to keep the Holocaust very big and alive for the reasons that I've already discussed. So we know that the so-called gas chamber crematorium is fake at Auschwitz, and everything about it is fake, including the non-working tall chimney that the Soviets built in 1946. Now, have you ever been inside one of the barracks? Has anybody been inside of one of the barracks as they were furnished during the 1939-44 time? No, they took a couple of barracks in the front and they stripped everything out of them and they turned them into a museum spaces where they take the tourists and show them photographs and artifacts and whatever they want to convince them that certain things took place there. And that's also in these buildings where they have the big cages of hair and old shoes and suitcases and stuff like that and all these kinds of exhibits. But all the other barracks that are there, which were pretty nice barracks because they've been described by people who saw them back then, they're all locked up and they don't let you go in there and see anything the way these people live in these barracks. And the only barracks you can go in that are supposed to be real are at Birkenau, where they stripped everything out of them and just made them, and they didn't look like that when the people were actually there, with just nothing but wooden bunks with no bedding or anything, and it's looking very gloomy and unlivable. But that's what they want you to see, and that's what they show you, and that's what they create for you. And who's done all this? The Russians, with the Soviet Union, with the Poles helping them, and the Jews. It's not real what you're looking at. It is just like a movie set. So it's very fitting that these Hollywood moguls continue to oversee the actual memorial, which they call a camp, which is not a camp anymore. It's just their idea of making a set of a camp. And they continue to dramatize it, as they're so good at doing. There's a story that came out during this past week. Auschwitz anniversary gets Hollywood touch, and it's from Los Angeles. And it's basically put out as a press release from the Steven Spielberg Shoah Foundation. The Shoah Foundation is one of the big sponsors. It says right here, the USC Shoah Foundation announced Tuesday that Hollywood heavyweights such as Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Harvey Weinstein, CBS Chief Les Moonves, CNN President Jeff Zucker, and designer Diane von Furstenberg are helping to develop programs for the Auschwitz Past is Present Remembrance. That's the theme they came up with. The past is present. They want people to think that it's present. And they call it these anniversary events will bring educators and survivors to visit the German death camp in Nazi-occupied Poland. Yep, these are the Jews telling us this. I've added in movie set, so it says German death camp movie set in Nazi-occupied Poland. But they're a Hollywood committee, and they're part of the team that's working to bring 100 Holocaust survivors to the commemoration ceremony. Ronald Lauder, the World Jewish Congress is playing a big role, along with Spielberg and his Shoah Foundation. So they work together hand in hand, very closely. And let's take a look at these Hollywood heavyweights. Six that were named, they're all Jews, every one of them. See, there's nobody, they don't even want anybody but Jews to be running this whole show. They've taken over the Holocaust. If they weren't in charge of it totally in the beginning, they were, you know, kind of in the background. But now they come right out in front, and they're just, they just run the whole show, and they trust one another. And here you have, and, you know, we're going to find that we not only have the Hollywood big shots, but we have billionaires. And some of them are the same. Some of them aren't. But they're all very, very wealthy. They're all Jewish. And here we've got David Geffen, who is second named after Spielberg. He's the son of Eastern European Jewish immigrants. He's openly gay. And having never graduated from college, he began his business career in Los Angeles by tampering with the mail. He really did. He worked in the mailroom of the company to which he was applying for a higher-level job that required a college degree. He intercepted and modified, in quotes, the letter sent from UCLA informing the company that he did not graduate from there. He modified the letter to falsely state that he did, and then passed it on to the company. You see, and that's talked about now, but it's almost like, well, he's a little prank. Wasn't he clever? Ha, ha, ha. So funny what he did. See, he's excused because he was born in 1943, making his parents Holocaust survivors of some sort or other, I suppose. So he can do whatever he needs to because he's had such a, you know, his family has such a hard time. Well, today he's worth an estimated $6 billion. $6 billion. Of course, he's the one who would approve of going after Vincent Renoir and trying to get blood out of a turnip and ruin him. They think that's just all fine. These people are beyond having any sympathy for any of them. Then the second one is Jeffrey Katzenberg, who has kind of a good reputation for being a very talented man, but he's a son of Jewish parents. His father was a New York City stockbroker. He grew up, you know, with the well off. And he's CEO of DreamWorks Animation, co-founder with Spielberg and Geffen. So these three, Spielberg, Geffen, and Katzenberg, are all worked together very closely, and they founded that successful DreamWorks Animation Studios. And Katzenberg was also chairman of Walt Disney Studios from 1984 to 1994. He began his career as assistant to Barry Diller, chairman at Paramount. Barry Diller is another Jew, big, big, rich Jew. He is considered, as Jeffrey Katzenberg, that is considered one of the Democratic Party's top national fundraisers. His estimated net worth is $1 billion. Then we have Harvey Weinstein as the third one after Spielberg. After, you know, Spielberg is not part of this list. Everybody has heard about Harvey Weinstein, another Jew, son of Max Weinstein, a diamond cutter, and Miriam Postol. He grew up in New York City. He's co-founder of Miramax Films with his brother Robert, and the Weinstein Company, also with his brother. He has been accused of being down and dirty in his business dealings, and there's any number of stories that can be related about that, but no time for that. And he's also shown a violent temper at times, and he's been involved in numerous lawsuits. High-profile guy, but I don't have his net worth here, but it's no doubt in the billions. Now, Les Moonves is another New York City Jew who was attracted to show business. He worked his way up in television and became chairman and CEO of CBS in 2003. And that was a time when CBS was the most watched television network. So he, you know, was seen as being very effective. He says now here's interesting. This Moonves says he's a great nephew of David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel. I'm sure he's very proud of that, you know, since he's Jewish. And he's very pro-Israel. And in 2013, he earned $65.4 million, the second most highly paid executive. So while they don't say he's a billionaire, he's been making from the $50 to $65 million a year for many years. And so if he doesn't spend it all, he's probably got a few billion put away, and he's got a lot of properties too. Another high liver. And then we have Jeff Zucker, who everybody's heard of. He was born into a Jewish upper middle class family near Miami, Florida, who he was the only one who was given a religious upbringing. He was bar mitzvahed and all that, and he was a good Boy Scout type boy brought up, but seeing he played football and everything, even though he's only 5'9", he seemed to be a kind of a driving, hard-driving person. And he was head of NBC for a number of years until he was appointed president and CEO of CNN Worldwide in January 2013. My, these people really go to the top, don't they? The very top. And finally, we have a female, Diane von Furstenberg, another Jew who was born in Brussels, Belgium, to Jewish parents. Her father was a Romanian immigrant. Her mother was Greek. And according to the story, her mother spent some time at Auschwitz before Diane was born. So a lot is made out of that. Oh, her mother was at Auschwitz. She was a Holocaust survivor. So that gives Diane, I don't know what it gives her, but she became famous as a fashion designer. She married a German prince whose mother was an heiress to the Fiat automotive fortune. She later divorced the prince to marry the American media mogul Barry Diller, who I mentioned earlier. So there you go. These people all have more money than they know what to do with. So after the Hollywood heavyweights that are so important in all of this come billionaires. The billionaires that are talked about are Steven Spielberg, Ronald Lauder, and Haim Saban. They've joined together to mark the 70th anniversary of Auschwitz-Birkenau. This is an article written by a Noah Klieger, who has a real pure Jewish point of view here and makes up a lot of things or tells a lot of untruths in his article, which, well, I can't say where it was originally published, but I got it from Shalom Life. In any case, some of the outrageous things he says, or interesting things he says, is that he starts out, "As the years go by, we move further away from the Holocaust. The number of survivors drops, and it becomes increasingly difficult to remind the world of the horrors they went through." See, now, what's wrong with this is that it's natural to move away from things and forget about supposedly bad things that people went through. And it's psychologically unnatural and sick to keep people living in some dark period of the past rather than letting them forget it and be happy in the present. No, the Jews don't want that. They have to make sure that we're all reminded all the time of this horrors that they didn't even go through such horrors, but the horrors that that Jews went through, and no one can ever forget it. And we have to keep reminding ourselves. They say it's so that it doesn't happen again, but that's not the reason. Because it doesn't mean that's not going to cause it to happen again because people forget about it. It's all the real reason is so that the Jews can keep using it for their own benefits and advantages. That's the reason. They don't want to let it go. So these three American Jews, Spielberg, Lauder, and Haim Saban, who is not an American Jew, but he might live. He's Israeli American now. Okay, he's an Israeli American media tycoon. They've joined something, and they're working on the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp. And this writer, Klieger, calls Auschwitz the biggest Nazi death camp, where some 1.3 million Jews, 85,000 Polish people, 75,000 Soviet prisoners of war, and 23,000 gypsies were murdered. Now, it's important to know that you don't have to believe what these people write in these articles. This man either doesn't know anything, or he's just making it up, or he's pushing the numbers as far to be as much larger as he feels he can get away with. Because, even the plaque at Auschwitz-Birkenau now says 1.1 million were killed, mostly Jews, but here he's got 1.3 million Jews, 85,000 Polish people. We don't know what I don't know anything about that figure, 75,000 Soviet prisoners of war. But here's the one I do know, 23,000 gypsies were murdered. Well, no way were 23,000 gypsies murdered at Auschwitz, Birkenau. In fact, none were murdered. And the gypsies had it pretty good. They lived in family camps. They had their own family sections, and they didn't separate the families at all. And they didn't even have to work, for the most part. The gypsies, unless it was something real simple, because I don't think the Germans felt they were capable of doing any of the war work that they wanted done or any important work. So they just wanted to keep them out of the general population because they were a problem, you know, and they stole and they were criminals, basically. You know, the National Socialist Third Reich was much stricter about criminality than the Weimar period or any other periods in Germany. And so these people were arrested because they were committing crimes. And you don't have to commit a huge crime. If they were going around stealing from people and so on, you know, pickpocketing and so on, they were taken to the camps, and that's where they were kept, but they weren't murdered. In fact, I at one time looked into this quite a bit, and the number of gypsies who died during the war of all causes or whatever, who were, you know, was no more than 20,000. Well, they try to make it, you know, 2 million and so on to get a bunch of money the way the Jews get money. But it was no more than would die normally, maybe a little bit more, but, you know, from just because people die. And this is over a period of like 5 years or so. But that's the accurate figure, like 20,000 gypsies less after the war than there was before. Now, here we can talk about Vladimir Putin showing up. But before we do, I think I'm going to take take a little musical break. I'm going to play that fun song by Charlie's Orchestra called, the title is Making Whoopee, where you hear the orchestra leader maybe making some comments that are very interesting. So here we go. We'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Have asked Eddie Cantor to write a new version of his famous old-timer, Making Whoopee. In one of his latest programs on the air, he sang the following song. Another war, another profit, another Jewish business trick, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of dough, a lot of gold, the British Empire's being sold. We're in the money, thanks to Frankie, we're making whoopee. Washington is our ghetto, Roosevelt our king. Democracy is our motto, think what a war can bring. We throw our German names away, we are the kikes of USA. You are the boys, folks. We are the boys, folks. We're making whoopee. Thank you.
we're back, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I didn't make too much noise. I didn't put my mic on mute. And sometimes, you know, it picks up just everything. So it's hope I didn't disturb your enjoyment of that piece of music. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this you're listening to the Heretics Hour. And we just went on our, we just came back from our mid-show break. It will be going on for another 55 minutes or so. And I'm talking about the January 27th commemoration date coming up, a commemoration at Auschwitz-Birkenau, and also at the UN coming up on that date, which is only 15 days from now. And the kind of attention that's being given to it and what they're trying to do with it. Now, they're saying that they hope it will be the biggest memorial seen so far, and they only started in 2006 with this, so it's now, this will be the 15th, so 9 years or so, but they want this to be the biggest one, and they are trying to get as many, they expect royalties, presidents, and prime ministers from nearly 100 countries to attend, and Russian President Vladimir Putin will reportedly attend, too. He has indicated that he would come. And, of course, he loves the Holocaust. He believes in it 100%. He, at least he says he does. He wants the Russian people to do so. He's made a law against, in Russia, making any questioning of the Nuremberg Tribunal results, I can't think of the right way to put that, to be illegal, and then you get fined and you go to jail. You go to prison if you question the truth of the findings, that's what I'm trying to say, the findings of the Nuremberg Tribunal, which is pretty crazy. So he's extremely anti-National Socialist. He's a part of this war going on. He's on the other side from us, if you are on the side that, if you're on the National Socialist side. They say that the organizing body includes the Polish authorities, which is the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, which is run by Poles, although a lot of these Poles are Jews. And it includes Yad Vashem, for some reason, the chairman of Yad Vashem, Avner Shalev, who is definitely Jewish. And they also bring up that the international organizations, for example, March of the Living and others, have implied that U.S. President Barack Obama may arrive for the main ceremony. So that means they're trying their darndest to get him there. And the way I see that, if they can get someone, if they can get Vladimir Putin, but even more so, Barack Obama, it would create a lot of news stories, a lot of news interest for them, and they'll be written up all over in photographs and so on, which brings that much desired attention and focus for, and nobody can miss it really if it's news about Barack Obama. Everybody's going to see it. Everybody who's got a thinking brain is going to see it and be impressed with the importance of this event at in Auschwitz. So. And then again, they talk about the 100 Nazi the 100 survivors they're trying to get there. And they're going to, every one of them is given an escort. So they're not just asking these old people to come. They're getting them to agree to come, and they're doing everything to make it easy for them. I'm sure they're not going to spend a dime, and they'll get a lot of stuff free. And it'll all be paid for, and they even, each one has an escort to help them make the trip and help them with what they want to do, with doing things there. So, and then more things with these Jews. A major rally is going to take place in Krakow on the day before, January 26th, attended by hundreds of teenagers from Israel and the diaspora and delegations of non-Jews from Poland and other countries. But mainly it's being done by the teenagers from Israel, the Jews, the Jewish teenagers on whatever they're going to do the day before in Krakow. And also, one last thing here. Well, that's not too important. Okay, so I'll let that go. There's another press release, once again, about the 100 Auschwitz survivors that they're trying to get there. But here, in this part of it, it says, the World Jewish Congress and the USC Shoah Foundation will be among the organizations supporting this commemorative event. So there they are again mentioned. And I think they're the ones who are putting out all these press releases between Ronald Lauder and Steven Spielberg. They're doing all this publicity in advance. I don't think the others do. I don't think the Auschwitz-Birkenau museum, that's in charge of the whole movie set there, does it or can do it, because they're not familiar with the English press, the English speaking press, and so on. They're Polish, so I don't think that's why these other people are taking it over. And the main commemoration takes place in front of the infamous Death Gate at Birkenau. That's what they call it, the Death Gate. How stupid! Really, it's just enough to make you want to kick somebody. They set up all these bleachers or something so that people will be facing this. They call it infamous, but it's really famous because we see images of it all the time of that entrance into Birkenau. The Poland's president is going to be running the show there. And it starts at 15:30 local time, which I think is 4:30 p.m. And I've noticed years before, and I thought, why do they do it so late? It's almost dark when they do it. I don't think they want it to last very long, though. It's very short, actually, and they don't have a lot of speakers or anything. And then people are supposed to go on some kind of a, maybe they go on a torchlight walk around, but it can be so cold that I really wonder why they do it the way they do it. But I think everything is done just for the purpose of getting the right kind of photographs to send out to all the media to publish in their papers and on their internet and TV and so on. You know, some of the things they say are just so absolutely stupid. But here, Dr. Peter Sawinski, who's director of the State Museum, he's the head of the Auschwitz-Birkenau movie set now. He's kind of new at it. But he said, this is his statement, until now, it has been them, he's talking about the survivors, how this is the last big anniversary that we can commemorate with a significant group of survivors. But he says big anniversary, which he means this is the 70th. The next one they could have would be the 75th, so they think that 5 years from now there's not going to be enough survivors to count much, so they say trying to make a lot out of this one. They'll find something else, though. But he said, until now, it has been them, these survivors, who taught us how to look at the tragedy of the victims of the Third Reich and the total destruction of the world of European Jews. Total destruction? See, what crazy talk. In the first place, just to call somebody a survivor, they want you to believe that they suffered horrible privation and so on. There's all kinds of survivors who didn't suffer at all, or who just, had a little bit of a hard time, as so many people do during a war like this. So, you can't assume that these are all people who suffered. And then he wants to go to these extreme statements and say that the world of European Jews was totally destroyed. Well, they like to say that, well, their little villages and their chattels and so on were gone, and they never came, that whole lifestyle never came back again. So they take that into the total destruction of the world of European Jews. But it says their voices became the most important, the survivors' voices, warning against the human capacity for extreme humiliation, contempt, and genocide. So this is what the Nazis did to these Jews. They made them suffer extreme humiliation and contempt. And Jews don't like that. You know, Jews want to dominate. Jews want to be in control. They don't mind if they are causing others to feel humiliated or in contempt, but they don't want it for themselves. Now, another person who's mentioned here, I just think it's kind of interesting, is Marek Zajac, who is secretary of the International Auschwitz Council. They have a big council for whatever it does, probably raises money. But this man is the secretary of it. He's a Pole. He's Polish, but he's a religious journalist in Poland. So he is saying, on this special day, we want to show the survivors in the whole world that we, the post-war generation, have matured to our own responsibility for remembrance. So everybody, you know, there's all this talk all the time about how anti-Semitic the Poles are and how the Poles don't like the Jews and how they're glad to get rid of them and so on. And now this man is taking it upon himself, because he's a religion journalist, to rehabilitate the image of Poland, which the elites there constantly do try to do. And he's saying, making out that he's taking moral responsibility for the Poles, in a sense bowing to the Jews and saying that, well, we want to show the whole world how we've matured since then, and we've matured to our own responsibility for remembrance. It's just the words they use are always so meaningless, really, but they're the words that are supposed to have a certain meaning, and so he's playing that role. Ronald Lauder talks about how he took it upon himself 20 years ago when he first went to Auschwitz to raise money for the preservation of the camp, because he says at that time it was deteriorating, and he set himself a goal of preserving the site. And of course it should deteriorate. It should just deteriorate away and go away. But they don't want that, so he has along with a couple of others, Jews, raised $40 million from 19 countries. And a lot of this is not Jewish money, but it's, European money, in order to ensure that what remained at Auschwitz-Birkenau forever be preserved and bear witness for future generations. And he also financed the creation of the conservation laboratory at the memorial, which preserves, listen to this, this conservation laboratory preserves every shoe, every document, every building that remained at the site. So what we've got here is, once these Jews get in the picture, they make sure things get done. If it was up to the Poles, this place would have deteriorated and would have eventually been just a part of the past. But the Jews are capable, more capable, and more concerned about it, and they've taken control of this whole site. And I don't think the Poles have much to say, and they're happy to turn it over to these big-name Jews, and they no doubt treat them with respect and so on. And so they're doing everything, and they're making this place last forever, because as they've said, this is the Auschwitz is the center of the Holocaust, and it's, well, I think I've got some of that coming up, so hold on a minute here. So let me skip some of this. Oh, they say that the archivists from the AB State Museum, with the help of these archivists, the USC Shoah Foundation, Spielberg's foundation, has identified the children from the historic photo taken by Red Army photographer Alexander Vorontsov. The one they're talking about is the one of where those kids are in there haphazardly dressed in these, some of them are, some of them aren't, in these striped shirts that are too big for them. And they're behind the barbed wire, and as though they had to be, because the war, it was all over. But they put them behind the barbed wire and took their picture as though, oh, here's these poor children child prisoners here. And these pictures were taken several months after the so-called liberation, but they're supposed to be liberation photos. And these children are supposedly now between the ages of 81 and 86, and they've been invited to participate. So that ought to be something to be looking for, that they're going to announce and they're going to present these old folks who were the kids in that photograph. You see, and that's another thing that Spielberg is behind, and see how well that comes off. So more on the World Jewish Congress, Auschwitz. Who said this? World Jewish Congress CEO Robert Singer made this statement, which has a lot of strange stuff in it. Auschwitz is not only the world's biggest Jewish graveyard, it is also the primary symbol of the Holocaust, the biggest organized mass murder in human history. And this will probably mark the last time that so many survivors will be able to join us there. And we must ensure that the unspeakable suffering they and many others had to endure at Auschwitz will not be forgotten once they are no longer among us. Well, you know, he calls it the world's biggest graveyard. Boy, the stuff they come up with. Where are the bodies in this graveyard? They'll say, oh, it's all the ashes. Well, where are the ashes? How can you call it the world's biggest? He calls it the world's biggest Jewish graveyard. It always has to be the Jews. Always has to be them. And he calls it the primary symbol of the Holocaust. That's what I was referring to just a minute ago. And the Holocaust is the biggest organized mass murder in human history. So he doesn't say that Auschwitz had the biggest. I was going to question that because, of course, it's not. They claim more murders in the Reinhardt camps than they do at Auschwitz. But he worded this so that it says Auschwitz is the world's biggest Jewish graveyard. I don't know how that can be, but the primary symbol of the Holocaust. And the Holocaust itself, all in total, is the biggest organized mass murder in human history. Well, all that can be questioned. All that is not true. I'm stating flatly it's not true, but I don't have the time to go into all the details. I don't even want to have to write about it. Other people have written about it, so it's just not true. But they make these statements anyway, and they make them over and over and over again. And, of course, this business about unspeakable suffering, that everybody who stayed at Auschwitz-Birkenau underwent unspeakable suffering, which is just another big farce. A lot of people didn't suffer at all. So just as many, a lot of them, not just a few, but a lot of them didn't suffer at all. And some of them had a harder time. But they certainly didn't undergo what they want you to believe that they did. Finally, something that other people have talked about in the Allgemeiner, they just wrote about it, but I don't know if they've come up with it. But there's supposedly 1.5 million visitors to Auschwitz in 2014. This would be from the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial of this information. They would be the ones that would know that. And they reported this on Friday, that 1.5 million visitors, that there were 1.5 million visitors to Auschwitz in 2014, more than ever before, and 70% of them were under 18. Ha! Well, what does that tell you? They're under 18 because they're school kids who were forced to come, or who were brought anyway by their schools and by organizations like the British British Council of Jews or whatever it is, who organizes all these trips of British kids to Auschwitz. So that's why they're under 18. They didn't decide on their own that they wanted to go there, and they were taken there by their schools and their different organizations, like civic organizations and so on. Now, I thought that was interesting. So you get a lot of this information, and you have to really look at it. You know, now, Poland led the list with the most visitors, naturally because it's right there in Poland, so easy for them to go. I guess. I think they'd get tired of it. But after that, Great Britain, 199,000. 398,000 Poles visited Auschwitz last year, in 2014, is what they're saying. And the second most is Great Britain, 199,000. You know that by far the greatest part of that is school students. And the U.S. is trailing way behind Britain with 92,000, and the U.S. has a much larger population, but we're not directing our kids there to the extent that Britain is. And we're farther away, of course, but I don't think that matters much. It may be just more resistance here to going. After that's Italy, 84,000. After that, Germany, 75,000. Then Israel, 62,000. Spain, 55,000. After that, a little bit less is France, and then a little bit less than that is the Czech Republic. And finally, South Korea at 41,000. Those are the top visitors. I'm glad the Japanese aren't going so much. What is it? Well, the South Koreans are so influenced by the United States propaganda. Now I'm going to just mention here that the biggest supporter, it seems to me, the biggest supporter of this UN-mandated commemoration is Britain. Britain, United Kingdom, and their BBC. There is, there's just, the Jews are just totally entrenched and in control in Britain. I think so. The whole United Kingdom they are. But in England, very much so, and London, very, very, very much so. And they just really run everything. In fact, the director of BBC television is a Jew, Danny Cohen. And here's a quote from him. He says, "The liberation of the camps is a very significant anniversary, which the BBC will mark with a range of thought-provoking programs. Alongside new documentaries and drama from acclaimed performers and producers, the BBC will re-show Shoah, that movie, that horrible, stupid movie that's really full of fake stuff. It's going to re-show Shoah in full and provide coverage of the Holocaust Memorial event." And so this is the list of what the BBC is going to do. They're going to present BBC One is going to present a story of remembrance on someday, and also on the 27th, three extraordinary women tell their tales. This is the one. One of them is Auschwitz, is Kitty Hart Moxon. Boy, she is a liar beyond belief, who's going to tell about her post-war struggle, to talk about her suffering. Acclaimed children's author Judith Kerr, K-E-R-R, is going to tell the story of her childhood escape from Nazi Germany. And senior reform rabbi Laura Janner Klausner travels to where her ancestors lived to learn about their fate at the hands of the Nazis. And the next show, they're going to have The Big Question on BBC One, a one-hour special looking at issues involved, to man's inhumanity. And after that, also The Eichmann Show on BBC Two, starring Martin Freeman. Who is he? I think he might be thinking of a different Freeman. And Anthony LaPaglia. The Eichmann Show, about the televising of the 1961 trial of Adolf Eichmann. Oh boy, that ought to be good. Tell us how evil he was and how he is responsible for killing so many Jews. And it's accompanied by some other drama. Then they have Touched by Auschwitz, BBC Two. a documentary by critically acclaimed filmmaker Lawrence Rees. Oh, he's a Holocaust historian. He's horrible. The film presents a compelling portrait of the problems, challenges, and triumphs that six different individuals have experienced since the war as a result of their time in the camp. And finally, no, not finally, one of several more things, Holocaust, Freddie Knoller's War, BBC Two. This is the title of it, Holocaust, Freddie Knoller's War. Tells the extraordinary story of a 93-year-old Holocaust survivor. Oh, he's a young Jewish man in World War II and blah, 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 blah. His journey took him to 1940s occupied Paris, where he lived a champagne lifestyle with Nazi officers and dancing girls before the war eventually caught up with him and his horror in the camps began. Oh, boy. And then, finally, they're going to put on Shoah on BBC Four. They're going to re-show in full this big, absolute fantasy, talk about a Hollywood production, Claude Lanzmann's 1985 acclaimed documentary series, Shoah. It's just all trash. It really is. So, in closing here, before I go to the phone and see if somebody, the person that's there, would like to talk, what we need to remember, folks, we need to remember that it isn't true, as I've been saying all through what I've been reading here, but it isn't true. And we don't need to, number two, we don't need to respect or feel sorry for these people, and we don't have to believe them. Of course, I do that, but I'm sitting here on my own in my house on my radio show. If I'm out in public, I'm not too ready to express these things, but I would if it came up. Of course, I really would to anybody around where I live. If the subject came up, if there was some discussion of it, I would, I'm not going to go and knock on their door and try to tell them about it, but I wouldn't be afraid to do that at all. And then they get all, but, it's just, we don't need to do it, and we shouldn't do it. And number three, we shouldn't believe them ever. We should never believe them. These people are saying these things. Some of the things they say might be true or might really have happened, but we shouldn't just believe them because they say it. We have to see proof. We have to see evidence of what happened. Number four, remember that it's all a continuation of the war, which really goes back to World War I. World War II was a continuation of World War I, and the Holocaust industry is a major force in the ideological war that Vincent Renoir is so very good at explaining. Don't forget to watch his video. We are in a state of war, and the International Day of Commemoration in honor of the victims of the Holocaust is a battleground in that war. That's why they put so much attention on it, and that's why the UN, got approval of it at the UN, and why they've made as much as they can out of it ever since. And it's not an easy job because people are not too interested, but that's why they try to get all these famous people involved in it, charismatic people. And going on, that this is a battleground in the war, that's why we have our own January 27th commemoration named International Day of Commemoration in honor of the revisionists who introduced sanity to the Auschwitz death camp, in quotes, death camp is in quotes, narrative. And I just say, please go there and support it. It's www.january27.org. And remember that this is a war. This is a war. And I would like to also invite people who have some talents to, if they want to contribute anything, at january27.org for the material that will be presented for the 70th anniversary this year, coming up very quickly, but if you have anything that is of a quality, essay, a poem, just some comments, an article, please don't hesitate to submit it, and you can send it to info@january27.org. info@jan27.org. I didn't forget anything last year, just asking like this, but I hope I might we might get something this year. So there's still time, and I do invite people to do that. And now I'm going to open the phone lines, as they say, see if there's any phone calls, and let me answer this person who's on the line. Hi there. Who's on the line? It's
hello.
You, Addie. Yes. Hi. I hear you.
Yeah. Good. You should really vote the phone number as a way for people to listen, because it works better than the Blog Talk site. And
I gave the phone number twice in the beginning. You might have not been listening then, but I did talk about it at the beginning of the show, and I read out the number twice.
I couldn't hear the first half hour, but you could have people driving down the interstate listening to Carolyn Yeager on their cell phone.
So it adds
a whole dimension of possibility for listening. And nobody's supposed to go on the air unless they press 1. That's what everybody is told when they call. The message says that.
So, did you press 1?
No.
No, because if you pressed 1, I would see this little this blue circle to the left of the red microphone. And I've seen that in the past, and I didn't know what it was. But now I do. I found out, so now I know. But I haven't seen any blue circles tonight, and no other callers except you listening. So do you have anything to add here, Hattie?
No, I was just sort of relaxing and listening, and then I realized it was going to be on the air, so I staggered over here to the microphone and waited to go on the air.
Okay, good. Well, what about that article you sent me? I thought that would be something pretty good to talk about, particularly in light of the Charlie Hebdo thing. And in fact, that's why it was written, I think, by
William Salatin. Actually, from a couple of years ago.
Oh, is it really?
That was a couple of years ago. Yeah, that's written actually to claim that a video made in the United States had provoked the attack on the U.S. embassy in Libya. That's what provoked that article. But the statement that it makes is very good, which is, it says, how is it that we can have prohibitions against questioning the Holocaust and against criticizing Jews, but we don't have the same prohibitions against criticizing Islam? And Muslims are looking at that hypocrisy and saying, we need to have the criticisms against Islam also banned. And this guy, William Salatin, says, no, what we need to do is have free speech on all these things. That's what
he
says.
Right, right.
Which is what Obama said
that
at the time. It's what Obama
said
at the time.
Obama said that, what Salatin said, and when did he say that?
Yeah.
When?
At the time. This was, I don't remember. It was, but Salatin quotes him.
Oh, right? Okay.
And, it's
you mean
it's
like
very
a couple
important
of years ago?
Yeah, in 2012. September 2012 is when that article was written.
Okay.
And
I've got it up here now.
I think it's an important point that he makes there. I was saying the same thing without knowing that article ever existed, in relation to what happened with the Charlie Hebdo, which is, consider the fact that certain people are immune to criticism, but they're going to throw criticism at you all the time, and they're going to get special police protection while they're doing this. this really invites political violence, I think. It's a kind of a situation that has to gall people. I can understand why people would resort to illegality under those circumstances.
Well, sure. I think it's excellent. I think we should all, everybody should be bringing this up as much as possible, that Jews are the only ones who are able to define hate speech against them and have it put out of circulation or have it, you know, criminalized. And they put revisionists in jail. They put people in jail and fine people for having an opinion that the Jews don't like about the Holocaust or World War II or Adolf Hitler or the Third Reich. Nobody else has that privilege. Nobody, nothing. That just goes to show. Now, this has been said many times, but more should be made out of it. It's absolutely wrong to give this privilege to Jews and the things that they think of as holy and not give it to... But they try to bring out that, because it leads to genocide, it leads to this, and 6 million were murdered. None of that is true. So it's all. But even if it were true, they shouldn't have the right to stop people from saying what they want to say. Some of these laws are written so strangely to me, saying you can't defame the dead. What is that?
Germany did. I mean,
yeah, that's Germany's stupid stuff.
Defaming the memory of the dead. Yeah.
Right. And now, and it's only the Jews that you can't do that to. You can do it to anybody else. And then they take you to court like they did with Vincent Renoir. What do you think of that? That's pretty amazing. I say...
it's a video. They find him, 70,000 euros because
he... They find him 20,000 in damages, but it... what it said that the ads on top of that there was fines, different fines that add up to 70,000. There's 20,000 in damages and 70,000 in fines. You know how they do that?
Because he made an adaptation of some cartoons from Charlie Hebdo to show to his friends.
Right,
and somehow Charlie Hebdo finds out about this, Ritz
is scarred.
Takes him to court for it.
Ritz is scarred for life from seeing that. Doesn't make sense.
Well, he's dead now, isn't he? I guess.
No, I thought. Oh, good. I thought he was one of them, but no. I went and found the list of who died, and he's not on that list. So he wasn't there. But I'm sure, it happened to all his friends and associates. There was two Muslims on that list, at least two, and some Jews, quite a number of Jews. But I think Renoir makes a great point that since they stir up all this stuff, they have it coming. What do they think is going to happen?
That's similar to what I'm saying. What he says is that the war continues, which is similar to what I'm saying, although maybe he goes farther with saying that it's a war. I'm just saying that the law and the enforcement and the allocation of rights under the law in France is clearly very biased. And you have to expect that this is going to lead to violence sometimes in reaction to the injustice of the way things are set up. But it is not legal in France to, as I understand, to criticize racial minorities. But you can criticize religion. So Charlie Hebdo attacks Catholicism, they attack Islam, right? But not racial minorities. They don't have a problem with, huge numbers of North Africans and Arabs coming into France, as long as they become immersed in the hedonism of France and don't become serious Muslims or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's perfectly okay with Charlie Hebdo for France to face a racial decline through immigration, just don't have any high ideals about religion.
Yeah. Well, and that shows how they get the laws the way they want them. The laws are all set up to just protect them and their interests, and not they're not set up to protect religion. There's the religion of Judaism
except
is
the
not
religion
protected.
Of the Holocaust.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't think there should be laws protecting religion either, but I think there should be sensitivity about things like that. And when it goes too far, I think that's very wrong. I don't know what you do about it, but mostly pressure, moral pressure or something. But well, the trouble is they still put it out as being true, as being the truth. And it's not the truth. And but they hate people like Vincent Renoir, who does such a good job of pointing out that it's not the truth and that it's just political. It's political pressure. It's the people in the politics that's in power now. We need to do a better job. Well, I think revisionism does a good job in pointing out that it's not true. But they have the control of the media. That's one of your favorite themes. When they have control of the media, it's very difficult. How do we get control of the media away from these scumbags?
Get control away from them, what you can do is build your own media, which we can do pretty easily now with internet to some extent anyway. If you can just attract people to pay attention to it.
You know, I think that almost all of the people who listen to my shows are people who are kind of, you know, in the movement. I don't think that I have many listeners who are outsiders who would be hearing something for the first time, or not maybe for the first time, but, you know, not all that often, that might be swayed. Although I have gotten mail that says, boy, I've come a long way, and I thank you for all the things you have been saying, and I've learned a lot. So obviously they had to be persuaded to really accept things more than they did before, but that's only far and few between. Not, of course, most of them would never write, but... Well, I don't know what you think. Just recently, there was discussion about who is it, and that he wasn't. Oh, it was Oh gosh, the guy who wrote the new book, Breaking the Spell. What's his last name? Nick Kolostrom. A very good book, but he says some things. You know, he's a very Jewish friendly, and so some people were saying, well, that's probably okay because he can reach people who aren't ready for the other with some good revisionism. He does a real good job in revisionism with the I've got a quote from him here or something from his book that I thought was pretty interesting. Well, it's up here in the top, but he does a great job of talking about the science at Auschwitz, and mostly at Auschwitz, maybe some other places and all. But he's one of those that doesn't like the Nazis, and he doesn't want to endorse anything that would somehow appear to be endorsing the Nazis. And I read the other day or today that on page 32. I don't have his book, but in a footnote 35, he essentially denounces Nazis, saying he cannot endorse Zundel because of his pro-Nazi views. He goes on to advocate a universal human revisionist movement. Now, what's that going to be? You know, so you have a lot of people like that.
That sounds like the kind of thing here from. Critics of the State of Israel, I hear this kind of thing, where they even want to call the Zionists Zio-Nazis and stuff like, you know, they're sort of, I don't like that kind of rhetoric, of course. And they haven't really debunked the whole Jewish lie when they're saying that, and they're reinforcing it to some extent, you know. But I feel like rolling my eyes and smirking and shaking my head when I hear people talk like that, you know.
Well, you know, he comes from the academic liberal background, and he got convinced about 7/7 and 9/11 and then 7/7 because he's English, and he got kicked because he didn't believe, he wrote about 9/11 or maybe it was 7/7. He wrote a whole book. He's supposed to be the expert on what happened in, I guess it was London, but on 7/7, where those Muslims were blamed for blowing up those buses,
the trains
or whatever, and he was thrown out of his university where he had been a teacher. He's in good standing, you know, a professor. And so he stuck with his guns. He's a very honest person. But like so many of them, he's this universal humanist.
There are a lot of them out like that. Yeah. These leftist, they're kind of people that listen to Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are somewhat onto the fact that there was lying about the Second World War, that there's been lying about Iraq, you know, and I'm sure that when Kofi Annan in September 2001 said that the State of Israel needs to stop using the Holocaust as an excuse, that's just the tip of a huge iceberg of people who realize that this Holocaust thing is an important political weapon for the State of Israel. And the left, I think, is pretty overwhelmingly critical of the State of Israel. So they understand the importance of this Holocaust myth.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a lot of them are at least somewhat open to debunking it. But, you know, they don't want to go the extra step of looking into whether maybe Hitler wasn't as bad as everyone says. I guess they haven't seen the necessity for that. They're still making use of that myth of Hitler.
They make use of it. That's right. That's the only thing that bothers me. I could say, well, you know, they're reaching people that way and you know, leave them alone. Don't argue. Don't say anything bad about them. Let them do their thing. But at the same time, I do realize that they are what was the word you used? They are reinforcing the fact that they're reinforcing part of this Holocaust. And we're gonna, if we went their way, we would still have a Holocaust. It just wouldn't include gas chambers and a few other things.
It's progress, though. I mean, it's progress,
right?
Because what kind of a devil is Adolf Hitler about the Holocaust?
Yeah, right. It is progress. So we should just be happy that these people and people like Jim Fetzer, who I've never cared for, but he's come around because he's good friends with Nicholas, with Nick. So he's come around too to saying absolutely the evidence for the gas chambers doesn't exist. he's not at all ready to rehabilitate Adolf Hitler. And none of those people are. No, so but
this
it's okay.
This is bound to happen sooner or later.
Yeah,
but that guy has no criticizing Zundel. Zundel is a completely likable person.
Yeah, that's what I'm sure he thinks he's likable. But see, he's got these principles, we all have our principles. But I found that kind of shocking, really, that he could say that he didn't, that he couldn't endorse Zundel, simply because he liked Hitler, was a National Socialist. I lost that quote already. Here it is. He can't endorse Zundel because of his pro-Nazi views. See, so that's like me saying, well, I can't endorse Nick Kohlstrom's revisionism because of his anti-Nazi views.
Yeah.
See,
the thing I would have to do is to ask him just what it is about what it is that he thinks National Socialism was, and what is it that he thinks they did, since he doesn't, if he doesn't think they did the Holocaust.
Yeah.
What is it that's so bad there that's still justifying that stigma?
Yeah, good point. Okay, well, we got our warning for the end of the show, Patty, and I don't particularly want to go over. So I want to thank you for being here and adding to the last part here. And I'm going to turn on our Heretics Hour outro music right now. Good night, everyone. Thanks for listening.